From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, we present the first of three installments from the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled, In the Bible, Return to Akedah, Why I Love Isaac. Introducing Professor Wiesel is Boston University President Emeritus John Silber.
I am pleased to introduce the 35th annual series of lectures by Elie Wiesel. The lecture tonight will be the 104th in this series. Each fall, for 35 years, Elie Wiesel has given three lectures, and the attendance has never wavered, but has often increased. Tonight, I think, is about the largest that we've had. The interest in hearing his highly original and important lectures has continued undiminished. The format of his lectures has also remained unchanged. The first is dedicated to an issue or an individual in the Bible, the second to the Talmud, and the third is a lecture on an issue of current importance. As author of Night, a worldwide classic, Elie Wiesel needs no introduction. His unique contribution to humane values in his writings and in his personal engagements has been recognized many times, among others by a Nobel Prize for Peace, by the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and so many others. Since we last met, he has received the Thomas Lantos Human Rights Prize. At the presentation, he spoke of meeting with human rights victims from around the world who have shared their stories with him. He has made their cause a part of his mission. I quote, to go and collect their tears and make them into stories. That is his description of his message and his mission. He has become the custodian of memories of the victims from the Holocaust to human rights outrages throughout the world. This year, Elie Wiesel, who was the founding chairman of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, was presented the first U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum Award on May 16th in Washington, D.C. The award ceremony was a part of the museum's Days of Remembrance program. Of his work in his austere life, Elie has said, and again I quote, we are people who do not sleep much because the world does not let us sleep. And we, in turn, try not to let the world sleep. It has been his mission to inform people throughout the world of the plight of those who have been victims and to tell their stories with vividness and emotion that makes us feel in our own being the outrages victims have suffered. Although a gentle man of peace, Wiesel spoke out with regard to the death of Osama bin Laden. He said in part, war is never just. In bin Laden's case, there is no doubting his responsibility for countless attacks, nor do we know what horrendous acts he may still have been planning. And so it is understandable that we respond to his undoing with a certain amount of satisfaction. Most important, we are grateful to our president for reconfirming our faith in the nation's leadership and the ability of our men in and out of uniform to restore some semblance of order, however fragile. The book of Ecclesiastes says it most clearly. There is a time to mourn and a time to rejoice. And so, let us rejoice and hope that this will be a time of rededication to the ideals of peace, cooperation, and mutual respect among nations, all concepts that bin Laden sought vainly to destroy. End of quote. On this occasion, as on so many others, Elie Wiesel has expressed the views of people throughout the world. Tonight, he has chosen a supremely difficult topic. In the Bible, Return to the Akedah, Why I Love Isaac. The Akedah refers to the binding of Isaac following God's command to Abraham to offer Isaac, the son of his old age, as a sacrifice. And Abraham, knight of faith, as Kierkegaard described him, was obedient to that command. Tonight's topic is a study in paradox, and no one navigates paradoxical waters more skillfully and with as much understanding and penetration as Elie Wiesel. Did God command Abraham to kill his son? Was the son compliant? Did his mother agree? Did the father take on this dreadful responsibility? While Wiesel focuses on why I love Isaac, can he avoid considering why we also love Abraham? Can anyone understand Abraham or the Akedah? How can this be explained? Kierkegaard regarded it as something that required a teleological, that is, a purposeful suspension of the ethical. Abraham set aside what is right and what is wrong in order to accomplish a goal of greater importance, namely his obedience to God's command. But was it God's command or Abraham's desire? Abraham's duty, Immanuel Kant would have held, was to act in accordance with an ethical suspension of the theological, that is, to subordinate theology in order to do one's duty. These are the troubling waters that Elie Wiesel has chosen to navigate, and I am pleased and grateful that I may pass the responsibility of answering these imponderable and paradoxical issues to our great teacher and friend, Elie Wiesel.
John, the answer is no. But let's try. First of all, tonight is a very special night. November 9th is a commemoration of, in a way, of the Kristallnacht. Kristallnacht was, of course, known for what was done to the Jews in Germany in those times, breaking the government sent troops. They were all employed by the government to break all the windows and to destroy whatever existed in Germany. And tonight, what else? Tonight also is known because it was the night when, the day when in Israel Yitzhak Rabin was murdered. It hurts, but a very so-called pious, demented young man killed the Prime Minister of Israel. So we remember many things, but tonight, of course, we go back 3,500 years and we shall see Isaac. Isaac, who I say, yes, I love Isaac. There are many protagonists there, but he, for tonight at least, is my favorite. At the outset, therefore, you should remember that I love Isaac with all my heart for a variety of reasons. The most important one being that he had lived a unique moment in Jewish history. No one has known the same solitude or a similar anguish. In all the texts, ancient and contemporary, relevant to the biblical tale, much is being written on Abraham the father and his ultimate test or trial, but not enough about his son. Granted, the original story, particularly, is the high holiday liturgy, the source. That place does bear his name. It is called Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac. But it is still centered on Abraham, on his faith, his absolute faith in God, the grandeur of his soul, his passion for the creator of worlds, whose ineffable name he, Abraham, made known to all human beings in the universe. That was the greatness of Abraham. He was the first messenger, the first witness to God's uniqueness. Of Isaac, we know only rare or bare essentials, that he was almost sacrificed. He has seen the fierce look in the eyes of his old father. He has seen the cold knife in his hands. He felt it on his throat. He was going to die, but was saved, ultimately, by the voice of an angel. Usually we are so totally taken by Abraham's determination to obey God's order without experiencing the slightest doubt, without asking him a simple question, why do you want me to do that? For what purpose? We are so taken by Abraham that we are not aware of his son's unspeakable suffering. What does Scripture tell us? Vayehi achar hadvarim ha'ele, after all these things, which means after the 9 trials which Abraham had to face and overcome, God imposed upon him the 10th and last trial. Take your son, he said to him, your only son, the one you love, and go with him to Mount Moriah and bring him to me as a fiery offering. What followed is known. The journey lasted 3 days and 3 nights. Vayelchu shnehem yachdav. They walked all the time together. 2 servants accompanied them, but they remained behind. While Abraham and Isaac were alone, each existed only for the other. So I am fond of Isaac. Do I like him because he suffered so much? Probably. I like him because he was used by the Almighty in a situation in which, on a personal level, he did not have to be involved. If God wished to test Abraham's faith, why did his son have to undergo fear and trembling? What has he done to deserve such an ordeal? Can or may a human being be used as a means, even by the Almighty himself? Does it mean that the son's faith also had to be tested? Why? Does it mean that the son's faith in his father and above him, the father of all of us, had to be tested again? Is he, Isaac, meant to be their victim? Who is the central figure of the story, Abraham or Isaac? Or their common creator? I like Isaac because of what happened to him, and it seems unjust to me. If Abraham and God had a problem in their relations, Isaac did not. And he endured meaningless agony on the altar, which he and his father were ordered to build together. From any angle we view the event, all of them, my sympathy goes to Isaac. Doesn't he remain in our collective memory as our first survivor? But then the question arises, was he really? How then do we deal with those great ancient commentators, great sages, who believe that he has not survived? Vayashav Avraham el Ne'arav, we shall return to his verse later, that Abraham returned to his companions. The verb is in singular. Abraham returned from Mount Moriah alone. Here, the father left the son behind. We may feel sorry for the father. Somehow, theologically, it makes sense. But I like his son. Can we imagine his loneliness? Of the three patriarchs, Isaac is the most tragic. He had various problems from his childhood on. His mother, Sarah, was barren for 20 years. His two children, mother, quarreled among these youngsters. His wife helped the youngest to betray him by cheating on the oldest. As for his father, Abraham, he was ready to kill him just to please God. What a life! No wonder that in his old age he became blind. Why see such a hostile surrounding, such a dark world, filled with fear, a fear that since the Akedah never left him and us? What kind of history is ours? But in the shadow, the fiery shadow, the father almost became the killer of his son. Oh yes, he had problems with Ishmael, his brother, but they made up at their father's funeral. He, Isaac, died at 180, old, says the text, svayamim, ripe or saturated with years, as if to say, it's enough. He was fed up. The saddest aspect of the Akedah story has to do with its end. In more than one source, we encounter the hypothesis that actually, we don't bear to say it, actually Isaac was not saved on the altar. In other words, as if heavenly intervention had arrived too late. And when we say too late, we know that tragedy occurs. That is why the word Vayashav and Abraham returned is singular. Midrashi commentaries hasten to elaborate on it, evoking Afar Yitzchak, the ashes of Isaac, that is the expression, as some way playing its own role. When in the high holiday liturgy Isaac is mentioned, it says the ashes of, please help us, have pity on us, for the sake of Isaac and his ashes. In other words, he was slain and burned, and we even know where, buried on Mount Moriah. But then how is one to explain his subsequent marriage to Rebecca? Oh, it's simple, he resurrected. One source says that after the confrontation with death on Mount Moriah, Isaac returned to his mother. Listen to what is supposed to have happened at that moment between them. Where do you come from? Sarah asked. From Mount Moriah? And Isaac says, do you want to know what happened there? And Isaac told his mother the whole story. The test, the miraculous outcome, and she let out an anguished scream and died. But another source brings it with its own correction to the event. It did take place. However, the informer was not Isaac, but Satan, who came disguised as Isaac. In still another version, we know that Satan came to Sarah disguised as an old man during the Akedah, as a witness to the Akedah. Where is your husband? He asked Sarah. Oh, he went to his work, Sarah answered. And your son, where is he? He went with his father to study Torah, she said. You poor old woman, Sarah said. Satan said, the teeth in your mouth will be set on edge when hearing what happened to your son. Don't you know that Abraham took his son with him on the road to sacrifice him? At that moment, Sarah's loins trembled and all her limbs shook. She was already absent from this world. Then she took hold of herself and said, all that God told Abraham to do, let him do it. So she was somehow a participant in the story. Another version of the same event. It was Isaac who told the story, not to his mother, but to his father. The son desired to convince his father not to go through with the deed. And this is how he used the following argument. He said, Father, suppose I die under your hands, what will you tell my mother? The truth? She will die. And Abraham in the Midrash answers, both your mother and I will not survive you more than 3 days. And that happened. In still another version, Abraham returned home alone and was met by Sarah, who exclaimed, so, it's true what Satan told me. Our son Isaac was sacrificed, and so distraught was she that her soul left her body. What had Satan told her? In the Bible, the deed is not done. Isaac has a future. He gets married and has 2 children, and Sarah never met his wife. Isaac mourned her for 3 years. These are the missing years in his life. He spent them in a yeshiva, according to one source, or in heaven, according to another. When did he die? Later, probably elsewhere. But his ashes, we are told, were buried on Mount Moriah. This we know from a much later episode. When the exiled Jews returned from Babylon and were ordered by Nehemiah and Ezra to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, one of them remembered its place. How did they remember the place? They remembered that Isaac's ashes were underneath the ruins of the first temple. One Midrash believes that at one moment, when the Akedah was still a project, Isaac realized the truth of the situation and that he tried to dissuade his father from going through with his plan. He knew of the rumors that were going around about his birth. People were saying, according to Rashi, that he was not of the 100-year-old Abraham, but King Avimelech's. Now he used it as an argument saying, I am ready to die, but what would it do to you and your reputation, Father? If you kill me, people will see it as proof that the rumors were true, that I am not your son. For if you were my father, you would not put me to death. No true father would do that. And says the Midrash, Abraham replied with counter-argument, Hineni bedi, you are my son, and I am your father. That is why I must obey God's will. If you were the son of Avimelech, I would never have the right to kill you, for he is unworthy of serving as God's burnt offering. In other words, it is precisely for that reason that I must slaughter you so that people will admit that you are my son. The relationship of young Isaac with his old father is not really recorded. What happened before? We know what is known is that Abraham has given a festive party in honor of the birth of his son. Of his son? No, not sure. It is quite possible that the father's intention was to honor his beautiful barren wife, Sarah. Both words are in the Bible. But what about Isaac's early years? He was 37 during the Akedah. 37. What had he done before? Did he go to school? Did he work? Did he pray? We don't know what happened in his life. So why not use imagination which is in the Midrash. He must have been spoiled by his mother. Especially so since his father was too busy, always away, converting lost souls, teaching strangers, fighting kings. And so to young Isaac, the Akedah must have been a special moment in his life. You know, life is not made of years, life is made of moments. And that was a very special moment. The very idea of finally having a bonding experience with his father, who was always absent, couldn't but appeal to the son. To be alone with him, for him, without being disturbed by anyone, not even by his mother. To discover together faraway landscapes, to bring an offering to God together, Yachdav, on a distant mountain. Then one morning, at dawn, while everyone was asleep in the house, including Sarah. And the Midrash says, actually, that is why Abraham could go away with their son. Had she been awake, she would never have allowed her husband to take her son away, knowing or guessing what could have happened. But then, while everybody was asleep, Abraham woke him up. He woke up his son. Isaac must have been convinced that they were going to experience a great adventure, filled to Kierkegaard's language, fear and trembling, which lasted 3 days and three nights. They didn't talk much. Was it because they were both overcome by emotion? Their silence became a language in itself, interrupted a few times by Isaac's curiosity, which turned into fear, and Abraham's brief replies. Where are we going? Asked Isaac. And why this lamb? Nearing Mount Moriah, Abraham asked, do you see the mountain? That's where we are going to bring an offering to God, not telling his son that he was meant to be the offering. Thus we are on the edge of one of the most traumatizing events in biblical history. Question. Does Isaac at 37 know the tragic truth of the situation? Did he have some foreboding? Father and son built the altar together. Isaac carried the wood on his shoulder and the fire in his hands. At what point does Isaac realize that the burnt offering will be he? Is it when he is looking for the lamb and doesn't find it? Aye hasel ha'olah, he asks, where is the lamb for the sacrifice? And the father answers, Hashem yareh hasel ha'olah, God will show you the lamb. And he leans over his son who lies on the altar. The knife is in his hands. In a sense, the deed will be done. But a heavenly voice intervenes, Al tishlach yadcha lanar, do not lay thy hands on the boy. Abraham obeys. What about Isaac? Does he find the strength in his being to respond to what his eyes had just seen, to the pain he had just endured? I love Isaac. His father loved him. God loves him. His mother loved him. We all love him. Actually, God loved him so much that he wanted to receive him as a burnt offering. And yet the emphasis in this ancient text, the emphasis is placed on his father rather than on him. At the very outset, therefore, we must say that something is wrong with the story. I don't understand it. I don't understand God. I don't understand Isaac. Nor do I understand Abraham, although we are told again and again that he was a man of faith, a knight of faith, as Kierkegaard calls him, which means whatever God asked, he would do with love, as Rashi says it, with love, because simply God asked, whether he liked it or not, whether he was willing or not, God asked, and that had to be sufficient, and it was sufficient for Abraham, God's knight. Well, the pain? What about the pain, Isaac's pain, and maybe even Abraham's pain? Father and son, after all, are there. In the beginning, what we know, we hear only a dialogue between God and his chosen friend and ally, Abraham, for whom it is fate, his fate, who will be the last trial. The other nine implied his life. That last one targeted his sons. Until now, Abraham was at the center of everything. The long waiting for his wife's giving finally birth to a son. The battle with the five mighty kings of the region. His plea to God to spare Sodom and Gomorrah from total annihilation for its sins. Everywhere he preached faith and allegiance to the only God in the world. The style is terse, the tale condensed, the content rich in thought and dramatic drama. When Isaac asked him a question, whether a profound one or practical one, he answers with a short syllable, Hineni, here I am. He seems to have neither time nor patience to engage in long discussions or explanations. At what moment then does our sympathy leave Abraham and goes to his son? I love him. When Isaac was born, we are told he was born on Passover at noon to two old parents. We are told that there was laughter everywhere. That's why his name was Isaac, Yitzchak, he who will laugh. At that time, we are told, several miracles occurred. The blind began to see and the deaf to hear. Why the name? It is linked to laughter. First, it was Sarah, then Abraham, followed by Ishmael. And finally, says the Midrash, Yitzchak, he will laugh. God himself in heaven will join in the laughing. Why were they all laughing? Was he there to laugh about the destiny of the central character of the story? What was it which must have been sad, melancholy, if not despairing? What kind of laughter was it? Isaac spent his life in Beersheba until the age of 37, when he was taken by his father to Mount Moriah. But soon after, he became an orphan of his mother. Together with his strange brother Ishmael, in a moment of sublime yet sad moment, they buried their father in Hebron. Abraham was there also, for he delivered a moving eulogy at the funeral. From this, by the way, we learned that eulogies are being obligatory at the funeral of someone. But did he and his son Isaac, Abraham and his son Isaac, speak at that occasion? Not sure. If so, why isn't it mentioned in the text? Now, we know what Abraham was thinking. But what about Isaac? What were his thoughts? It was the first time, again, the first time that they were alone. He must have been happy, maybe exalted. And when at one point Abraham stooped to cut some wood placed on his shoulders while he himself carried the knife and the fire, at that point Isaac must have understood or guessed that the journey had a specific goal, to bring an offering to God. But something had to disturb him. He was unable to repress his anguish. He expressed it in one word, Father, Abraham responded in two words, Hineni bani, here I am, my son. What a sentence, here I am, comma, my son. Here I am, my son. I am your father and you are my son. And Isaac continued, I see the fire as I see the wood, but where is the lamb we are supposed to sacrifice? A perfectly logical question. Abraham avoids it, saying, God will show it to us. It is worth noting that Isaac does not include the knife in his question. Was it due to some nefarious intuition on his part? Or is it that he was too young to comprehend the tragic implication of the moment and its immediate future? Many Midrashic commentaries insist on his youth, he was 37. But in that case, why is he referred in Scripture as Hannah, the adolescent, the lad, Is it possible that he became younger, weak, fragile, and vulnerable on the altar, nearing his death? That he became a child? It happens that a person becomes a child just before he or she dies. The opposite would have been more reasonable, that the person can age during an extremely tragic event. I myself have met a Jewish journalist from America who spent the war years in London. Every evening he would cable his short report, which was limited to 300 words. And one day his article included information about what was happening in Poland's ghettos and death camps. And there was too much to say and not enough words. He spent hours to find them. In the morning he went to the washroom. He looked in the mirror and did not recognize himself. His dark hair has turned white. But in the Akedah, strangely, Isaac is old in the beginning and young at the end. For those of you who are old enough to remember accompanying us since the beginning in this very hall, studying together, have surely realized that the Akedah continues to fascinate me more than any other text in the Bible. This episode has been haunting my writings and my entire existence. But each time I return to it, I come closer to Isaac. It is enough to go deeper into the text and the numerous commentaries, especially Shalom Spiegel's Midrash Akedah, or in English, The Last Trial, to become aware of its extraordinary importance. Couldn't Jewish history be defined as a series of sequels of what had taken place on Mount Moriah? The father who, during the Crusades, slaughtered their children in synagogue courtyards to save them from forced conversion? Were they not following in the footsteps of the first believer by adopting his eternal fidelity to God? Haven't we forever remained what the Gerer Hasid called an Akedah folk, or the people of the Akedah? Doesn't the Akedah accompany us to this day? In the Midrash, a great sage, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, wonders, why doesn't the heavenly voice telling Abraham to spare the life of his son? Why not God? Why only an angel? Both questions related to the event remain the same. Why does the text on Isaac seem so poor? Isn't he a principal protagonist in the story? In other words, why does God seem more interested in the father than in his son? Thankfully, some Talmudic sources rectify this error as always, if indeed it was an error. As we often witness in the Talmudic universe, our ancient sages do try to show all aspects, all possibilities, all hypotheses linked to difficult questions and situations. But remember, one goal is always to study and learn and go deeper and deeper and feel rewarded, offered precious gifts of extraordinary importance to not only to Abraham and Isaac, but all their descendants. We shall delve into pages of ancient Midrashic sources as we have done, all filled with audacious beauty and grave imaginary discoveries. The term Midrash comes from the word drosh, which means to demand, to study, to extract hidden meaning from the depths of ages. Sometimes it takes centuries to come up with success. If it takes longer, we shall continue searching and digging. The texts occasionally are mystical, and then time itself will change its pace so much that success would seem almost unattainable. So what? Learning carries its own reward. Waiting for the Messiah, who is bound to be laid, is already a messianic experience. What was Isaac waiting for? If indeed he was so old, why was God waiting so long to make his father undergo such a horrible test? Why didn't the Akedah occur earlier? Here the Midrash does not hesitate to answer. Isaac had to be old so that people do not say, look at him, he is too young, too weak to resist. In other words, surely Isaac must be considered a victim of God or his father, but still a consenting one. Said Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, son of Yochai, Isaac was already an adult in full strength. He could have given one blow to his father and saved his own life. But he used restraint. Why? Because he respected him. He obeyed the law. A son must respect his father and mother. Since Abraham decided to sacrifice him, he, the son, must not stop him. Thus the Akedah, a tale, remains a tale of their common submission. And so Isaac may be remembered as the first martyr of Jewish history. But doesn't an act of martyrdom mean a desire to please God by dying for him? Not killing? For the moment, let us stay with the father and son on Mount Moriah. We know Abraham's feelings, but not Isaac's, not yet. What did the event mean to him? What did it happen? Why? Some commentaries hold him unwittingly responsible. Facing his older brother Ishmael, he appears superior, if not vain. And their discussion turns around their piety. Isaac says, I am more pious. After all, I was 8 days old when my father circumcised me. Really? Answers Ishmael, that means that you were unconscious when I was 13. And then Isaac exclaimed, but I am ready now to give God my entire life if he wants it. This thesis supports the view that both father and son participated in the procedure. Isaac went as far as helping Abraham when being bound to the altar so as not to move, not to tremble, and be wounded by the knife, thus becoming an unworthy sacrifice. But then another sage doesn't agree. He declares that just before the act being completed, while Abraham was busy preparing it, Isaac pleaded with him, saying, Avi, Avi, my father, as if to say, remember, remember that you are my father and I am your son, just to arouse his compassion. Isaac did not want to die. But then at that moment, we are told, still other sources point at the arrival on stage of our old acquaintance, Satan. He's always there at the most critical moment in man's relations to his creator. Here he will do everything in his power to sabotage Abraham's plan and at the same time, for his own reasons, to save his son, to save Isaac from being slaughtered. Another Midrashic story, this time it involves again Satan, who is the bearer of truth. He appears as an old man who addresses Abraham, either as a young man who speaks to Isaac, it's possible, or as a young man. And he says, listen to his bizarre dialogue. He says, where are you going? Asks Satan. To pray, comes the answer. Then why do you carry fires, wood, and a knife? We may stay a while, perhaps a day or two, and need them to prepare sustenance. Do you take me for an idiot, old man, says Satan. It is you who will appear as an imbecile. You were 100 years old when you had a son, and now you are going to slaughter him? If you think that you are doing it for God, who gave you orders in a dream, you are wrong. God would never give such an order. And if he told you also in a dream to throw yourself in the sea and die, would you do that? It's marvelous. It is Satan who says the right words. Abraham refused to listen. But Satan now, as a young lad, asks Isaac, where are you going? To study Torah, says Isaac. When? Now or after you die? Come on, says Isaac. No one studies in death. Poor boy, says Satan. Do you know how many times your mother fasted for you to be born? And now this old man lost his mind and is ready to slaughter you? Nevertheless, answered Isaac, I shall not oppose my father's will nor God's. Still, something of Satan's poisonous words did enter Isaac, for he questioned his father. Have you heard what he said? And Abraham says, don't pay any attention. But then Isaac, do you know what this old man is saying? Is it true? And Abraham repeated, don't pay any attention to him. Did Satan's words really have no effect on Isaac? They did, but only partially. Was he simply a victim of a joke? Perhaps a heavenly one? Actually, he seems to have been more anguished later, much later, when his wife, Rebekah, who is now still a baby, thus absent from the Akedah, together with her favorite son, Jacob, organized a plot against Esau, Isaac's favorite. When Isaac realized that he had been cheated, Vayechrat charada gedola, says the text, he was seized by a great fear and anguish. But they were worse during the Akedah, is one view, but the other one is no, the Akedah was worse. So how can one not feel compassion for Isaac when his entire life was near tragedy? At one point in the story, Isaac becomes aware of what was going to happen. And this is accentuated in Midrashic sources, making him a voluntary co-conspirator in the sacred ceremony of sacrifice. They pour these words on his lips, please, Father, tie me well to the altar, tie my hands rigorously, lest I move accidentally and cause the knife to be impure. So then, if Isaac did not wish help to him, help himself, why should someone else? Actually, someone did, claims the Midrash. When the angels in heaven looked down and saw Isaac stretched on the altar under his father's knife, they let out a powerful scream, pleading with God to intervene. And their tears fell into Isaac's eyes, blinding him forever. But, claims another Midrash, the intervention almost came too late. The knife had already cut a slight wound in the victim's throat. Drops of his blood were shed. And here we come to almost the last question. Is it possible that the heavenly intervention by the angel did come too late? Almost all of a sudden, in 1 minute, in an I blink, what could have been the happiest moment in his life has turned into the darkest of Isaac, his father, a cruel vehicle of death. Isaac had never imagined that his father could be cruel, an instrument of death, of his death. What was his reaction? Did he try to dissuade him, to arouse his pity? Some Midrashic sources, yes, but only in a way. According to the painter Rembrandt, when Isaac repeated his words, "Are we father?" twice, he meant to remind him that after all, he is his father, that he cannot humanly go through with this act. No father would do such an unthinkable thing. An illustration, as it were, is offered by the great Rembrandt. It illustrates such a theory. In his museum in Holland, one could view a series of drawings showing the Akedah before he completed the effort for his extraordinary painting, which remains one of the greatest artwork in history. In the drafts, Abraham, knife in hand, has an expression of anger on his face. Angry at whom? At himself? At his son? At the father and creator of mankind and theirs? Is this then the story in the Akedah? A tragic situation in which the love of God in conflict with the love of a son. Whatever the motive, the anger dissipated soon. In the final painting, Abraham's face shows immense pain and profound compassion. Was Rembrandt sad for the father or the son? Whose plight was greater? Abraham's? Not necessarily so. After all, he only obeyed God's orders. But to whose will did Isaac submit? God did not even care to speak to him. Had God said to Isaac, I want you, you, Isaac, as the supreme offering. But he didn't. And so what did Isaac think? Is it possible that he felt sorry, not only for himself, but for his father as well? That God was somehow involved in his drama was clear to him, since Abraham in a way mentioned it. What then did Isaac think of God's role in history? He must have felt alone, abandoned not only by the person whose presence he sought all these years, but also of their common protector and benefactor, the source of all that is happening in creation. Well, now we know certain things, of course, but not all. We know that Isaac, therefore, was chosen by God, God's chosen sacrifice. In my first lecture on the Akedah here, I have given three lectures on the Akedah here in the last 35 years. In the very first, I remember, and I hope successfully, to offer my own interpretation on Abraham's part in it. I brought a large number of Midrashic commentaries proving that he, Abraham, never envisages to go through with a date. In other words, the man known for his humanity never considered even the possibility of putting an end to his son's life. When he said to his two servants who stayed behind that Hadar Vani, the lad and I will come back, in plural, he meant it literally, that both of them will come back, that he was never going to kill his son. We may, of course, wonder, is this possible? Did our father Abraham intend to cheat God? Didn't he know that God knows all our intimate thoughts, that he remembers what we have forgotten? In other words, if my interpretation is correct, then the Akedah was a double test. God tests Abraham, who in turn is testing God, as if to say, let's really see whether you, God of mercy, will force me to go ahead and kill my son, whom you made all these promises. And thus you could make peace with Abraham, who ends up obtaining great surrender conditions for the people of Israel from God. But what about Isaac? How can we forget his pain, his anguish, his fear on the altar? What was he thinking of his father and God? Especially so since we find Midrashic sources claiming, again, that it came too late, which invites the Midrash to wonder, when all this happened, what about Isaac? Where was he? At least, again, one source believes that he was no longer here. And then what? One source seems well informed. He went up into paradise to cure his wound. Another, equally well informed, places him in a yeshiva, where he stayed 3 years. Still another, also knowledgeable, accompanies him to his home, where he was greeted by his mother Sarah, still alive. As a good Jewish mother, forever worrying over her child's welfare, questioned him, where were you? What kept you away so long? And because he was a devoted son, he told her the truth. And that caused his death. But really, the entire story, and Isaac in all this. Some Jewish commentaries talk a lot about Abraham, but what about Isaac? Wasn't it his test also? Then what were his thoughts during the ordeal? What did he feel when he opened his eyes on the altar, seeing his beloved father with the knife in his hands? I said it, I repeat it. Midrashic sources depict him as a consenting victim, if not an enthusiastic associated partner. One Midrash says, while Abraham was building the altar, Isaac kept handing him the wood and the stones. Abraham was like a man who builds the wedding house for his son, and Isaac was like a man getting ready for the wedding feast, which he does with joy. At one point, when already stretched on the altar, he tells his father, please tie me harder to the altar. so I do not move inadvertently and make the knife impure by hitting it. That means that he, Isaac, age 37, was really willing to die because of an order given by God to his father. Why didn't he protest? Why didn't he say, if God wants my life, let him do it, let him tell me about it. I want to know. But on the other hand, is it possible that he had such love for and such faith in his father that till the last moment he was convinced that the story would not end in death? After all, he heard his father tell two servants, we shall return together. Remember, venashuva in plural, we shall return. Could Isaac have thought that his father was anything but a liar? And what about compassion and pity in all this? It seemed that the God of justice and Abraham, the man of kindness, have conspired together against Isaac. Did no one feeling sorry for him for that moment? Well, the angels did. They tried to prevent the trial, but didn't succeed. Angels do not rule the heavens in the world of truth. Now, what do we say again? What is going to happen? And did Isaac know? How much did he know? When did he know it? Interestingly enough, Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist philosopher, who didn't stop speaking about God in whom he refused to believe, he echoes Kierkegaard's anguish, which in fact reflects Midrashic sages. Sartre wonders, if an angel were to appear before me, where is the proof that he is really an angel? And if I hear voices, who will persuade me that they come from heaven and not from hell, from my subconscious, or from a pathological state of mind rather than from a holy source? Actually, in the Tractate Ta'anit, or on the Midrash Rabbah on Genesis, the suggestion is made that it's quite possible that the entire Akedah episode was nothing but a misunderstanding, a mistake on the part of Abraham. In fact, God himself tells him that. He said, go to Mount Moriah. That's what God says to his faithful servant, messenger, and friend. What were you going to do? Kill your son? But you haven't understood me at all. I did not ask you to slaughter Isaac. What I asked you simply, v'ha'alehu sham, you bring him up to the top of the mountain as if for sacrifice, nothing else. If Abraham answered God, it has not been recorded. Actually, Sarah is the only character in the story that died as a consequence of the Akedah. Why? I have looked for an answer in Midrashic sources without real success. She was involved in the event. Why then was she singled out to die? Is it that she died in order to atone for the sin of sending Ishmael away into the wilderness, thus exposing him and his matter to danger, to death? Is what Isaac lost his mother that reason? Is that why Abraham lost his wife? Was the Akedah simply a tale of correcting an injustice? So we come now to the end of the episode. Actually, all the participants ought to feel good about its outcome. Isaac for remaining alive, Abraham for being a father, and God for witnessing his loyal friend's fate emerging unscathed. Did Abraham ask Isaac to forgive him for his agonizing experience? Did father and son speak to one another then? We don't know, but I think not. The text would have mentioned it. The term yachdav, together, is no longer operative here. But God speaks. Not to Isaac, but to his father. Ataya dati, he says, now I know. Yetere elokim ata. Now I know that you are a God-fearing man, for you were ready not to spare your son, your only son, from me. Reread the passage and you will be surprised. What? God knows now? So late in the story? Isn't the Akedah Abraham's 10th and last trial? Weren't the previous 9 sufficient evidence? Various commentators raise this question. In general, God is God by definition omniscient, all-knowing about man's conduct, whether past or future. Could the answer be that God knew but Abraham didn't? Or that before God knew, but now he was certain? Well, many questions about the Akedah story remain questions, but the tale itself is still burning like an open wound. And so we come really in conclusion. What is the meaning of the Akedah? Is it that it does not only belong to the past but also to the future? That our people has been tested in its faith as well as in its resolve more than once? Does it also mean that the Akedah transcends centuries and frontiers on more than one level than one? Do I love Isaac because, as the first survivor of burnt offerings, he represents many children and many parents, even today? Do I love him because he remembered and is being remembered as one who had seen the fire? I also love him not only for what had happened to him, but also for what he had done with his memories. Rather than living a life of solitude and sadness, he married, had children, loved nature, and composed prayers and future communities all over the world. As for laughter, in his memoirs from Treblinka, a member of the Sonderkommando, the most despairing of all, a Jewish carpenter named Yankel Wirnick wrote, "Will I ever be able to laugh again?" For a long time, I believed that his question is the most somber and despairing of all that had been written by and about the tragedy and its witnesses. Then I discovered from the mountains of ashes in Birkenau the memoirs by a man named Zalman Gradovsky, also a member of the local Sonderkommando, and he wrote, "Will I ever be able to weep again?" Our forefather Isaac could have asked himself the same questions. It is up to us to answer him. For when we come to the end of the drama, on the surface, most of the participants ought to feel good about its outcome. Isaac for remaining alive, Abraham for still being our father, and God for being measured and reassured because of his friend's loyalty. Nonetheless, God never spoke to Abraham again. Does he speak to us? Well, did Abraham ask Isaac to forgive him, I asked earlier? Did father and son nevertheless remain united? We don't know. Probably not. Are they still Yahdav together? They remain together in all our prayers, in our wonder, in our sadness, and in our laughter. But above all, they remain together in our memory. For we remember the altar and the fire.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard the first of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled, In the Bible, Return to the Akedah, Why I Love Isaac. Professor Wiesel was introduced by Boston University President Emeritus John Silber. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.